And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Audible presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. First episode we've done, Bruce, in about a week and a half because we were both out of pocket last week. We're back, and there's not a lot going on in college football, but it is NFL Combine week. And, you know, on The Athletic on Wednesday, The Athletic, by the way, which you can subscribe to for $1 a month right now, if you go to theathletic.com/theaudible, you revisited your freaks list from last summer, and specifically in terms of guys to watch at the Combine this week. Number one, Aiden Hutchinson. We all know Aiden Hutchinson. Not a huge surprise there. But, you know, and guys like Evan Neal and Kyle Hamilton, who so many people aren't as familiar with, who we might be, you know, you might suddenly be hearing a lot about this week.
Tariq Woolen is a cornerback on that very good UTSA team last year. Incredibly long for a corner. 6'3 and a half, 205, really long arms. From the people I talked to, they think, as well as him, I talked to him recently. So this is, I don't want to say this is very different from the old freaks list. Like you said, there's a bunch of names that are carryovers from last year. Now it's been updated with, you know, I've talked to the guys who trained some of these guys, what they expect to do either here in Indy or at their pro days. Tariq Woolen's like, he did 11.5 broad jump at UTSA. He thinks he will be over 11 feet. He thinks he will run in the 4.3s. His numbers are insane. You know, he was number two on my list. Boye Mafi is at Minnesota edge rusher. He's 255 pounds. I was told recently he in training, he was running a hand timed 4.49 in the 40. I mean, just, you got some remarkable athletes. And then you got, I thought this was noteworthy. I got two guys from Baylor who I'm told have a legit shot to run in the low 4.2s. That's, you know, insanely fast considering the record's 4.22. Boogie Barnes is a defensive back. He's a former Texas State 100-meter champ and is somebody who I've heard has clocked in the 4.19 range before. And Tyquan Thornton is a taller receiver, who's a former 10 500 meter guy in high school who's also been in the 4.2s in training. So if you love the freaks list, or if you're really into the draft or the combine, I think there's going to be a lot for people to like and be interested in. Just from in this case, I talked to a lot of players, I talked to a lot of combine trainers. But even a lot of the players, I'd be like, who else do you think is going to, you know, wow you? And there's certain guys that didn't make the top 40. But I remember, you know, I talked to one player and I was like, who else are you training with? And he was like, let me tell you, Malcolm Rodriguez may bench like 40 plus reps at, you know, at 225, which considering he's a linebacker, that's an insane amount of strength. And we know, obviously, he was a really, really good player on the excellent Oklahoma State team this past year.
Can I ask you a quick question? As you're saying all those heights, weights, 40. Are you saying that, reciting that from memory? You're looking at me. You're not looking at a computer screen, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
You're so immersed in it that you can just recite guys. It's amazing.
I know, but I don't have to know all the grown up real world stuff that most people have.
I should mention, I tried, knowing that we were talking about this on a podcast and, you know, driving my daughter to school this morning and then I had to run some errands. You know how on The Athletic you can listen to, and I don't know if most people realize this, on The Athletic app, you can listen to an article. There's a, you know, you go into your, on your iPhone, like this.
So who voices like the freaks?
It's an AI voice. It's a woman's voice. It didn't work very well for me, at least, because, and I've listened to many feature stories that way. It's a perfectly good way to consume the story. But, you know, the AI voice gets a little tripped up on all that. There's so many numbers. And I was like, this, yeah, I'm going to have to read this article because this I'm not retaining this way. The other thing that stood out to me on here is how many Georgia guys there are. And maybe I shouldn't be surprised after we watch them win the national championship. And they're all on defense.
They are. There are four. There could have been a fifth. All defensive guys. And, you know, there's two walkers. You know, it's crazy thing is, like, the guy who might be the biggest freak of that defense, he's not even in this draft yet, Jalen Carter. You know, like, so...
Plus, Jordan Davis, who gets so much hype, is not one of the four.
He's not. He was the one I almost put in as the fifth. But, you know, you have... Let's take N'Kobe Dean out of it, because N'Kobe Dean's just, you know, he's unique. I mean, he does not have, like, great size, but he plays incredibly fast. He's extremely intelligent, and he's on there. But, you know, the walkers are both beyond prototype big, run really well. Devontae Wyatt, who was on the list in the summer as a 310-pound defensive lineman who is expected to run in the 4.8s, you know, it's just – it's not a – it's it shouldn't be a shock that – that Georgia had such a dominant defense when you have so many athletes in the front seven like they did.
One other name that I smile at seeing on there is Jeffrey Gunter from Coastal Carolina, edge rusher, because when I would watch Coastal Carolina, probably more so 2020 than 2021, when they were kind of the bell of the ball, I was like, who is this dude? You know, he stood out. He's big. And you know, especially in that BYU game that we all remember from that year, you know, really disruptive. I think, you know, we'll see. You know, I think, you know.
Can I throw one other wild card name at this? And this was, like, a lot of these guys were not on my list in the summer because they either emerged later or for a variety of reasons. But one of them, do you remember the name Armani Rogers?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so when one of the... scouts had told me about him, like, I was like, UNLV, I remembered he was in the MAC. I honestly wasn't sure if I got it backwards.
I feel like he was at UNLV a million years ago.
Yeah, and he, what, you know, it was pre-pandemic, so maybe that was, or almost pre-pandemic, I guess. But yeah, so he was at Ohio, and he does have an NCAA record for the longest touchdown run by a quarterback, but he is apparently just putting up ridiculously impressive workout numbers. And so there are times, and usually it's like some former power forward who does this, where people are like, oh, let's take a flyer on him as a free agent or something. And I remember talking to one of the coaches at Ohio this past weekend, who was like, no, he's definitely athletic. We just don't know. And he's, you know, he's got size and speed. I'm just, you know, I think they were a little skeptical that he would be a drafted guy, that somebody will probably take a chance on him, but not as a seventh rounder. But just, you remember like Terrell Pryor, who had, you know, obviously Terrell Pryor was a much better college player, not even close, but just where it's like, okay, this guy could be a, maybe not Randy Moss, obviously, but could be some kind of size, speed problem matchup outside. And so I'll be interested to see when he has his pro day or what that guy does. And a handful of these guys are not going to be at the combine, more than a handful. They're going to be guys just to know in the draft process.
So I wasn't wrong. Armani Rogers was the Mountain West Freshman of the Year in 2017. He has been in college. He was in college for 6 years. I don't remember. Do you know why? Why he was a three-year starting quarterback at UNLV. Why he transferred?
I don't. And I, you know, I still talk to Marcus Arroyo. I didn't reach out to him on this, not for any other
reason. Was he afraid he was going to get usurped by Tate Martell? I don't
know. Somewhere, I think when you say that, Ari Wasserman just has a little jingle in his shorts.
Well, all I know, look, good luck to him, and I hope he does well. All I know is Ohio last year, you know, Frank Solich retired, and they were terrible. You know, there's a team that would usually go to a bowl game pretty much every year under Solich, and last year they were awful.
I have a feeling we're going to be talking about Frank Solich another time on this podcast today.
I think you're right.
Okay.
Now, here's a different kind of segue. You mentioned all the Baylor guys at the combine. There's a former Baylor coach who was in the news again this week. Again, for the same reasons as always. Somebody tried to hire Art Briles. They claim that they, and this is Grambling, Hugh Jackson's the head coach there now. we vetted him. We want to give him another chance. Da 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 da. He starts the job there. There's a big backlash. He ends up resigning 2 weeks into it. Like, this is the third time this has happened, where somebody hired him and there was an uproar, and he, like, why do these schools keep trying?
Well, it was like, if I'm not mistaken, it was, and I don't remember the sequencing, it was either the CFL was first or Southern Miss and Jay Hobson, one of the two. I don't remember
which
was first.
I think CFL was first.
Okay, and then Jay Hobson, and then there ends up being a backlash to it. I don't know if this is, you know, where this fits in it, but just in terms of, like, people look back and say, well, what did he say? Like, there was the part about the NCAA's ruling, and it was like one aspect was trying to, like, frame it like, oh, he was exonerated. Then you'd look back and it was like, no, that's not what they said. So I think there's a lot of spinning that gets tied to it. I also think what made this particular situation even more toxic was the statements that came out of Hugh Jackson's foundation. Our colleague Jason Kersey was one. I saw it. He had pointed it out. It was just like, don't bring anything up about the victims, because it'll only, if you bring them up, it'll only cause more hurt or something. That wasn't it verbatim, but it was just, I think that was another layer that got people outraged about it.
Well, I mean, what really, you know, made it an impossible situation for Grambling, even if they wanted him to be the OC, was when Doug Williams, their famous, you know, Super Bowl champion quarterback, went public. I'm very, very disappointed in Grambling. I really am. He told the Washington Post following the hiring. I talked to the AD a couple times. They knew where I stood, but they did it. And if that's what they want to do, that's fine. I'm out. If you're Grambling, the choice between, you know, doing what Art Briles wants or what Doug Williams wants, I would think is kind of a no-brainer. You got to keep Doug Williams on your side.
Yeah, and for context, it's not just that Doug Williams was a, you know, former great player there. Doug Williams is very involved at Grambling. I had talked to a source actually the morning that it had come out, like the morning before it had come out that he was being pushed out there, Briles was, that Doug Williams not only was outspoken against it, but Doug Williams also is getting a lot of stuff done in terms of, like, he's building a research center on campus there. He has a lot of key people in his corner. And as this person put it, it was like, if Doug Williams wants something to get done, they want to make sure that they keep Doug Williams. They respect his wishes. And it's not, like I said, it's not just like, okay, this is the case of, like, a former All-American player just tweeting about something. No, this is a guy who is very involved in the university, not just the football program. And so I think, like, I have no idea if Art Briles will ever coach in a college football game again. My guess is someplace at some point will hire him.
How?
It'll probably be a small school. I think what it would be is someplace where there's a school that is even, you know, like, way off the radar, and there's not going to be anybody, like, to me, this is an example, and I could be not reading it entirely right, but from my understanding is because Doug Williams had enough influence and there were key people who spoke out against it who mattered there, that's what the snag was. If you had it where it's at a program or university where there aren't those people who are going to be outspoken, who don't have the influence, then I could see it being pushed through. In this case, that's what stopped it. I think, I could be wrong. It could, maybe other places, you know, whether it's a junior college, whether it's an NAIA school. I mean, what I go back to is, remember Dave Bliss?
He resurfaced at a high school, right?
Dave
Art Briles, by the way, was a high school head coach for a couple years recently. That he did get that opportunity.
Yeah, but somebody hired Dave Bliss as a college coach. It was maybe an NAIA school. I don't even remember. But, like, you know, and obviously if you ever watch the documentary on Dave Bliss, you're like, oh, my God, I can't believe, you know, like, who thought that was a good idea that, you know, you get other chances or whatever.
Dave Bliss, who tried to, he was the Baylor basketball coach when a player murdered his teammate, and Dave Bliss tried to get the tried to frame the player who had died as being involved in drugs and whatnot to try to like obscure the fact that they were also committing a bunch of NCAA infractions, paying players and whatnot. It was a mess. Well, I think what's happened over the years is the Art Briles camp has done a very good job of spinning what happened. And the basic message is that he got scapegoated for a larger problem that was going on with Title IX and sexual assault reports at the university. And that the Board of Regents, you know, to save face, they tried to pin it all on Art Briles. And that's very misleading. Yes, that Pepper Hamilton report, I mean, most of it, frankly, was about the university's overall just complete disregard for the Title IX process. But, like, both things can be true, right? The university was incompetent and dysfunctional. But also, Baylor had a whole bunch of players accused of serious crimes. And they have documented instances in that report where either Briles himself or the coaching staff tried to cover it up. So to me, that's a deal breaker. And, you know, some people, you know, the Hugh Jackson statement was about, we believe in forgiveness and redemption. And I'm not somebody who thinks that, you know, that nobody ever deserves a second chance, but I don't know that second chance in his case should be on a college campus in charge of a college football program after what happened at Baylor. He coached high school for a couple years. Nobody really made a stink out of that. I think if he became an NFL wide receivers coach, nobody would really make a stink about that. It's running a college.
You think nobody
program.
Would make a stink about that? I think you're wrong about that. Maybe semantically. I think because I was going to ask you not even an NFL receivers coach job, whether it's the XFL or the USFL. Let's say somebody decided to hire him as the quarterback's coach. I do think there would be people go, why would you want him representing your business in some capacity?
You may have actually found the perfect spot for him. The USFL, this thing that Fox is doing that I don't quite get. I was like, is there that much nostalgia out there for the USFL? But like nobody, there's no invested interest there. There's no, you know, there's no like diehard fans of the teams. I think that would basically go mostly under the radar. Am I wrong? Kevin Sumlin, by the way, is a head coach in the USFL.
Kevin Sumlin is a head coach of the Houston Gamblers. I think you will see some former Aggie assistant coaches
really
with him, I will predict. Yes.
Good luck to them. I hope they do better than the other spring leagues that popped up recently. I think the part I guess I'm confused about is the reason the USFL made as big a splash as it did at the time is that they had Herschel Walker and briefly Steve Young. Like they went out
and Reggie
they went out
White
and competed head to head with the NFL to get the best players.
And Jim Kelly.
The USFL held their draft the other day, and it's like, you know, Shea Patterson is like the biggest name quarterback.
Jordan Tamu.
Like these are guys who weren't good enough to play in the NFL. So I don't know why there'd be a overwhelming desire to watch them play in April, but you know, we shall see. I bet you're gonna watch.
I will, but I don't feel like I have like a lot of adult interest. So we're gonna play a little game that you don't know about.
Are we?
Stu.
Name the USFL right, head coach.
No, I'm not doing that to you. But I am going to say a player, and please tell me you're not going to Google. Are we on the honor system with this? Okay. I'm going to say a player, and you tell me what school he went to.
A player from what?
The draft. Oh. This is the fourth pick of the draft. His name, he's a quarterback for the New Jersey Generals, Ben Holmes. What school?
I don't have the foggiest idea.
Okay. It would be Tarleton State.
Ah, of course. How did I miss that?
The number six pick in the draft, this is a guy I think you may remember. Birmingham Stallions, Alex Magoo.
Nope, don't remember.
FIU.
Maybe I should since I was FBS.
Yeah, that's why I threw it in there. Okay. The number 9 pick of the draft, he's the top defensive lineman taken. Davin Bellamy, where'd he go?
Michigan.
Oh, Stu. I think you're thinking of...
Ronald. I'm thinking of Ronald Bellamy. Oh, you are. My bad. But I do recognize the name Davin Bellamy. Was he on Lane Kiffin's FAU team?
No, he was at Georgia.
Oh, okay. He was at Georgia. Yes, that sounds right. Was he a starter at Georgia? Yeah, I think he was on the team that lost Alabama in the title game.
I will be honest. So they went by positions, and so like from the ninth pick in the draft to the 34th pick in the draft, they were all defensive ends. So there's, I don't know what the
math. That's interesting. So they are basically saying after quarterback, the most important position is defensive end.
I guess. I don't know. But of these guys, so from Davin Bellamy, Carlo Kemp, I think you remember him. I think our listeners will remember him from Michigan. Mm-hmm. But then after, like, there are players that are on from schools that, you know, are on TV a lot. There's a D lineman from Oregon. There's two D linemen from Oregon.
Who's that?
Bryson Young.
Mm-hmm.
Gus Cumberlander.
I think Bryson Young was on Oregon as recently as 2 years ago.
I think both guys were. Then you have, you know, a player from Pitt, a player from Illinois. Adam Schuler, I definitely remember because he started his career at West Virginia and then transferred to Florida and had a bit of a track background. But it's like, you know, it is a lot. You know, it's Arkansas State, Tennessee State, Samford, North Greenville, East Tennessee State.
It makes me wonder if, Jackson State. Because wouldn't you think, I mean, there are some pretty big name college players that don't make the NFL. It's a little surprising to me that you go that quickly into the more obscure names. It almost makes me wonder if like there were just certain guys who said, I don't want to do it. You know, maybe.
I don't know. Like, one of the more recognizable names was the 43rd pick in the draft, Corbin Kafusi. Remember him? He was a 6'9 BYU player. But it's, like, it's really... you know, pretty far down. Even when you get into the DBs, like you get into the cornerbacks. I remember a Janie Harris because I, you know, he's played at USC. You would always notice him in the spring because he would do some good things. He would sometimes play offense. But, you know, there it's, you know, again, it's a lot of names. I think most diehard fans would be like, yeah, I kind of remember that guy, but I can't place where he was from, you know. When they had the second round of quarterbacks, so this is the 12th round. I'm going to read them off to you. Be honest. Tell me how many you remember. Zach Smith from Tulsa.
That's not the first name I think of when you say Zach Smith.
I know.
But was he he was a quarterback, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, these are all quarterbacks. Okay. Josh Love. You should know that
Josh one. Josh Love, not to be confused with Jordan Love, played at... San Jose State, right?
That's why for you know him, yeah. Jamar Smith, who I remember from Louisiana Tech. This name you won't remember at all, but it's somebody like, I know one of the private quarterback coaches who works for them, Kenji Bahar. He's at Monmouth. DeAndre Johnson. You know that name because I think he was on our podcast once.
Yeah. DeAndre Johnson, who started out at Florida State.
FSU, and then went to last FAU. Chance U,
yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And then ended up at Texas Southern. Case Cookus, Northern Arizona. I don't remember his name. And then the last two are like probably the most recognizable names in the entire draft. And they're the last two players taken in day one. Brady White from Memphis. Mm-hmm.
That's a big ASU. Name. I mean, that's a...
It is. Brady White has like 15
why
college
did he,
degrees.
Why did it take that long for him to get picked?
I don't know. I actually saw Brady White this June or July when I went out to Jordan Palmer's place. You know, someday Brady White will probably be owning a USFL team. So, and the other one, Paxton Lynch,
former first round
pick. I know.
There you go. Well,
all right.
Listen, the USFL's got bigger issues right now. They just got sued for trademark infringement. In spite of its full knowledge, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to throw Fox under the bus here, but this is the lawsuit. In spite of its full knowledge of at least 11 years continuous use of the USFL marks, Fox has continued marketing its counterfeit league as a, quote, relaunch of the USFL, the lawsuit reads. But I didn't realize this, but the person who's suing them, former USFL team owners and league executive Steve Erhart, Steve Earhart is the longtime director of the Liberty Bowl. I did not expect to see that name involved in this, but yes. So we'll see what happens with that. The league is supposed to kick off April 16th. I feel like the one of these spring leagues, the one that got the most traction a couple years ago was the AAF, right?
Well, the AAF started, a bit earlier. They were even more dysfunctional.
They flat out ran out of money.
Yeah, the XFL, actually, you know what's crazy is I didn't plan this. I have an LA Wildcats t-shirt on right now.
There you go.
My buddy Norm Chow, who lives not far from us, had given it to me. Like, I remember I took my son to one of the games at, StubHub or whatever we're calling the place in Carson that changes names almost as much as Pro Player. And it was entertaining games. You know, like, and there were some pretty good players. There were coaches people knew.
I felt like people, especially college fans, were getting into it, and then they stopped paying the players.
Cardale Jones, so the game we went to was Cardale Jones on the DC Defenders. I think Pep Hamilton was the head coach, I'm pretty sure. We went to that game. It was entertaining, I thought. So there's two things that it worked.
Wasn't Christian Hackenberg in that league?
He was. He struggled there pretty early on.
Compared to the names you were just reading me, I feel like that league was able to get bigger name players.
I don't know what was different on that regard. I don't know if...
Maybe they were paying more and that's why they went out of business.
Yeah, I don't know. I think what you're banking on is people are going to want to gamble. I mean, look, this is the first, like, because of that league, I don't know if it was the AAF or the XFL, I honestly don't remember, but we were watching the broadcast. It was the first time I've ever talked to my son about point spreads and try to explain it. And because it was on the screen and you're kind of like, the hard part on that is like, good luck setting a line on those teams, you know, because what are you basing it off of if they haven't played more than a game? At that point.
Well, so you talked about going to the game as a fan. These games are entirely for TV. It's an unusual situation. The teams have the same names they had in the 80s, right? The Birmingham Stallions, the Houston Gamblers, etc., New Jersey Generals. But they're all playing in one location in Birmingham, Alabama. So it's not like if you live in New Orleans and you're a big New Orleans Breakers fan, you can just go down to the Superdome or whatever and go to the game. They're playing all the games in Birmingham. So
yeah, I think the feeling is at some point they branch out.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Well, we were both in South Florida last week, coincidentally, but I just basically stayed on the beach. You actually did a little bit of work and went to UM and saw Mario Cristobal. What's going on there?
Well, a lot of big plans for rapid improvement of facilities. So I think they're going to have, you know, put shovels in the ground for a new football building very soon.
Much needed.
The stuff they have now is so much nicer than it was. Like, they have an indoor, which they've had for a little while now, but it was part of the old green tree practice fields, and there's a lot of stuff that has been upgraded there. There was a lot of energy in the building. You know, I got to see, you know, it was still a little crazy to see. You know, I saw Josh Gattis. Obviously, I saw Cristobal. I saw Joe Salavea. The one that you do a double take was I'm sitting in, like, the lounge, and here comes Charlie Strong, you know? And it's just, like, just to see people out of context, you know, like, in terms of, like, what you're used to seeing. And, you know, he's there, Kevin Steele there. It's, you know, it's a, it is a strong staff. Like, I expect before too long, they will probably end up adding Alonzo Highsmith in a capacity and personnel, which would obviously be a huge name for Miami fans. And so I think a lot of that has resonated really well. I think they're still going to have to be very active in the portal because there's still a lot of, there's still some holes in the roster, but again, it's relative compared to what they're going up against in the ACC. I mean, beyond Clemson, I think NC State's got a really good team coming back. But after that, I think it's, you know, it's not like they're playing in the SEC. So, it was interesting. Like, Mario has got a lot of stuff going on, and I think they are very, you know, he's all about recruiting, not all about, but he is neck deep in recruiting all the time. And, you know, you get that feeling when he's just kind of, you know, it's, I think, you know, they have like an hour recruiting meeting like every day.
Well, coincidentally, while we've been on the podcast, Manny Navarro, our great Miami writer, just published a new story, A Night of Recruiting with Mario Cristobal. Miami coach speaks at Lake Gibson, home to five-star cornerback Kermani McClain. It's basically a night shadowing him on the recruiting trail. So if you're a UM fan, you're definitely going to want to read that story on The Athletic. I just remember thinking, so I hadn't, you know, when we cover the Orange Bowl or national championship games there in that stadium, everything's in Fort Lauderdale. You never really, you're not in Miami proper.
Unless you happen to have to drive with Dennis Dodd, then you may end up driving by accident.
No, he does not have the best. You don't want to be in the car necessarily with. Are you still referring? Is this like? Do you have a more recent example of that, or you're still talking about that Virginia Tech Boise State game?
No. Like, I actually had a. He was driving me back from a media day. I think it was Clemson, Oklahoma. And it was amazing where, like, do you remember the Big Ben Parliament European yeah. vacation? Like, that's what it was like trying to get Dennis to drive out of the, you know, out of the parking lot of the stadium. I was like, oh, my God, we're going to die here. It's just like, because we keep going around in circles, like, he cannot figure out how to get out of the complex. But the time you're talking about, was Matt Hayes the fourth person in the car?
Yes. We ended up in
three or four different states.
Yeah, we were trying to get to FedEx Field, and I think we ended up in Virginia at one point. I remember seeing signs for things that are definitely not in the right direction of the football stadium. Anyway, so yeah, this is my, you know, we stayed at a hotel on South Beach, and not the, you know, I got a 6-year-old. We weren't like the Clevelander, like, we weren't the party section of South Beach necessarily, but South Beach is pretty vibrant throughout. And I'm looking around one night, we're walking to dinner, and it's just like, you know, it's a really exciting vibe. And it would be especially exciting if you're a 18, 19-year-old kid. And I remember thinking, man, Mario Cristobal is able to, you know, convince 5-star kids to come to Eugene, Oregon. He should clean up here. Like, he is such a good recruiter, and he has this to offer. So, and like you said, a conference that is not exactly daunting. So
no,
I expect them to be very successful very quickly. I don't know if that will be this year. You know, you can never really, you always have to temper expectations for year one he's there for a reason. They weren't very good. But I would think by the second year, and certainly by the time he starts getting in his own recruits, I've got a lot of optimism there.
The one thing that I think bodes well, in addition to some of those others, which just from, you know, the talking to a couple of the coaches last Thursday, was it seems like the buy-in from the guys they inherited has been very good. And sometimes that
doesn't everybody happen, say that, though? Doesn't every new coach say that?
It's true, but it's like, I think there's a shock to the system element. Like, I just remembered when Louisville took over, it was like a lot of players were desperate and, you know, wanted the change, because obviously the coming from Bobby Petrino was such a, you know, such a dark environment. But I think some of it was like, how ready are the players physically to jump into this? And I think so some of that, I think, has been promising, you know. So we'll see. You know, as a roster, from my understanding, it's like, there's three talented tight ends. Van Dyke obviously had a had an excellent freshman year, and I think they're optimistic about him. And then there's some other gaps in the roster that I think they really still need to address.
Let's do some emails.
As always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. The first question is from not that far away from me, Michael Galvin in Agoura Hills, California. We have all heard the story about Nick Saban sending his plane to East Lansing only for none of his assistants to board. This is back when he was taking over at LSU. We all know what happened to Saban, but what happened to the assistants? Did any find success? And have you ever asked any if they regretted it?
Stu, I love, you did some research. Yeah, I love this question so much that I immediately did the research. No, I have not asked any former Saban. Anyway, that story, as far as we know, is true. What we... In general, I don't know, but I don't know that we can say with any certainty that every assistant had an offer waiting for him at LSU. But great, you know, there's enough truth there that we're just going to go ahead and go down this list, okay? And in general, what you're going to find is a couple guys did really well, and then most of them not so much. So Bobby Williams took over as interim coach before the bowl game that year for Michigan State, and they won the bowl game. And he got the head coaching job. So I think we could say, even though that his tenure did not go well, you know, he got a head coaching job out of it. So good for him. The OC on that staff was Morris Watts, who himself would end up becoming an interim coach when Bobby Williams got fired. He was at Mississippi State for a little bit, then a bunch of MAC schools. Most recent evidence I could find was he was at Texas Southern. I would venture to say it did not work out all that well for him. Bill Miller was the DC, bounced around quite a bit, eventually ended up under Jimbo Fisher at Florida State, retired in 2019. You'll know this name, Bruce. Pat Rhule was the offensive line coach. Eventually ended up hooking up with Pete Carroll at USC and stayed with him for 15 years, you know, like the last 4 or 5 years at USC, and then a decade at the Seahawks, retired in 2020. So, never advanced beyond OL coach, but I can't say that necessarily. Like, I don't know. Where do you score that one?
No, he was a really good coach. He obviously won a bunch of, he had some rings from his time here at USC. So,
all right, we get to our first one who's still active. That is linebackers coach Bill Sheridan. He eventually became an NFL assistant for a long time and the Lions defensive coordinator for several years. And in 2022, he was recently hired by Paul Christ as Wisconsin's inside linebackers coach.
Okay.
The next name is Mark D'Antonio. I think it worked out pretty well for him.
Yes.
Within a couple of years of that, he got hired by Jim Tressel to be the Ohio State DC, and we all know what happened from there. Bob Casullo, C-A-S-U-L-L-O.
Casullo, yeah.
Went into the NFL. As far as I can tell, he's been out of coaching since 2010. Brad Lawing became... He was a big recruiting guy. He ended up working for Spurrier at South Carolina and Jimbo at Florida State. Not sure. I think he's retired. I'm not sure how long he's been retired. The running backs coach was Reggie Mitchell. Man, tracking down Reggie Mitchell was not easy. He was UTEP's running backs coach in 2019. And based on his Twitter feed, I believe he is now a coach of some sort at Missouri Southern. Is that an NAIA school?
No, I thought it was a FCS.
Is it?
I thought I could be wrong.
Missouri Southern, not Southwest Missouri, Missouri Southern. Last name on the list, though, Bruce ended up doing pretty well for himself, and that was one of his GAs at the time, a guy named Josh McDaniels.
Yes. This is where I feel like Saban was especially strong with the off-field staff guys who really seemed to flourish. So of that group, so Josh McDaniels was in it, and then previously, at one time, the GAs there were Brian Polian, who ended up becoming the head coach at Nevada, is now special teams coordinator at LSU. Brian Daboll, who ended up and is now the Giants head coach, and at one point was Alabama's OC. Mel Tucker, who was a GA there, and Mel Tucker actually was on Nick Saban's first staff at LSU. And so, but the one guy I think we know who did go, I believe, was Adam Gase, who was an off-field guy Michigan State, and then ended up, he went from being a student assistant at Michigan State to becoming a GA on the first LSU staff in 2000.
Yeah, so we were trying to figure that out. Adam Gase was a student at Michigan. He was still an undergrad when Saban left Michigan State. So he may be the one guy that actually got on the plane, but he was also just graduating from college. So here's the deal. Did Saban intend to keep all those guys, some of those guys? I don't know. But what I do think we can agree is that the staff he did end up assembling at LSU in 2000 was a much more impressive staff with the benefit of hindsight. Jimbo was his OC. Mike Haywood was the running backs coach. He, as you recall, eventually became very briefly Pitt's head coach and got into some legal problems. Rick Trickett was his first O-line coach. Rick Trickett was an offensive line coach forever.
And is still back as an offensive line coach. I think he's on Rich Rod's staff.
Tight ends coach, Derek Dooley, future head coach of the Tennessee Vols. Linebackers coach, Sal Cenceri, who ended up working off and on for Saban quite a bit over the years. You mentioned Mel Tucker. He was the DB's coach. Again with the GAs, Bruce. How is he so good with the GAs? Freddie Kitchens.
Yeah, Freddie Kitchens, who was an NFL head coach. Maybe the real star of this staff, and I don't want to, obviously, I shouldn't say quite like that, because Jimbo's had tremendous amount of success. Mel Tucker. But Pete Jenkins, arguably one of the best position coaches in all of football. Long-time defensive line coach. That was a big get because, as you remember, they loaded up
big-time
D linemen. The defensive coordinator, Phil Elmation, was – there's a couple guys like this. I want to say Taylor Stubblefield was like this as a receivers coach, where they've been a lot of places in almost like 2 years here, 1 year here or whatever.
Yeah.
Phil Elmation was that guy. He only spent 1 year as the defensive coordinator at LSU. But this is kind of interesting. So in 1999, he was the DB coach at Wisconsin. In 2000, he was LSU's defensive coordinator. 2001, he was West Virginia's defensive coordinator. In 2002, he was Marshall's linebacker coach. In 2003, he was Purdue's defensive backs coach. And in 2004, he was defensive backs coach at Nebraska.
So fast forward just 1 year to 2001 at LSU after there's been a couple staff changes. And who comes in? His new DC, Gary Gibbs. Gary Gibbs has gone on to be a DC several different places. His new linebackers coach, Will Muschamp. And notably, in terms of the impact he would end up having on the Nick Saban Alabama era, GA Scott Cochran.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, Scott Cochran, who was local there, was John Curtis' guy and obviously had a big role in player development later on at Alabama.
The man doesn't have many misses. Let's put it that way.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Okay, next one, Matthew Akers. Which fan base do you think has the most regret for firing a winning coach over the last 20 years? A lot is made about good and bad coaching hires without giving much thought to the firings that preceded them. My top three are as follows: Nebraska firing Frank Solich, Michigan firing Lloyd Carr, and Texas firing Mack Brown.
Those are good choices. I would lean towards the Nebraska one because it has been so dry since then. I mean, to me, the other ones, not quite as much. I mean,
I don't think even as much as Texas has struggled and as great as Mack Brown was for a long time there, I don't think you would hear from a lot of Texas fans who are like, we never should have fired Mack Brown because things had gone stale.
To me, the thing with this, Stu, is those other guys had been there for a decade plus as head coaches. So I feel like what happens is you get fans who are kind of tired of somebody. They're like, yeah, the message is worn out or whatever, and it's just kind of not resonating. In Solich's case, he'd been there 6 years, which is like, I think what kind of doomed him there was after...
because he was having to succeed Tom Osborne.
Well, yeah, but after three top 10 seasons in a row, they had a 7-7 year where they went 3-5 in the Big 12. And at that point, okay, you're on the hot seat. And then even though they were 9-3 and finished in the top 20, they pulled the plug.
Steve Peterson, a name that will live in infamy as the AD. I would put Tennessee Phil Fulmer on this list. And again, that was one where at the time, I don't know if it was unanimous. I think the fan base was split to some degree. But, you know, they were not where they were when he led them to the national title and had them in national title contention all the time. So I don't think at the time there was a lot of, I don't know if we should have done this. But the wilderness Tennessee has fallen into ever since then, the fact that he briefly came back as AD tells you that there was a lot of regret over how that ended.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think sometimes what you get into, I don't think almost any Miami fan would say any regret with this, but like Larry Coker's record when they fired him was pretty remarkable, especially considering what the next 10 years was or 15 years. But I think people felt like, you know what, this program is backsliding in a big way. He got the blame for it. And I just felt like, you know, for a guy who won a national title, Larry Coker's record in 6 years at Miami was 60-15, right? But it went from the team was ranked number one, number two, number five, number 11, number 17, unranked.
He never got any credit for, I think that a lot of, at the time it felt, people seemed to feel like, well, there was just so much talent, anybody could have done this. Like all Larry Coker did was not screw it up. And that's probably not fair. Yeah, knowing everything that goes into running a program, for them to go 12-0, 12-1, 11-2, I'm sure, you know, I'm sorry, but the head coach had something to do with that. Then it did fall off, and I will never, I still remember his last game was freezing on the sideline in the MPC Computers Bowl in Boise.
Did you cover that game?
No, I didn't cover that game. I just remember watching it being like, I just felt bad for him. He'd been fired, and, you know, but these were the days when they would just let the guy coach the bowl game, and, but they did win the MPC Computers Bowl over Nevada 21-20. Chris Ault, Nevada coach at the time. Bruce, I'm going to give you three guesses. Who was Miami's MVP quarterback in the MPC Computers Bowl?
So this game is 2006.
Don't look it up. Don't look it up.
No, but I'm like, Ja'Cory was not there yet. Nope. Kyle Wright was already gone.
Not sure. But he wasn't him.
It wasn't Kyle Wright, huh? Man. Ryan Collins was long gone. I'm trying to think who would have been. Give me a first initial.
K. Oh, wait. The first K. name or the last name?
Last name.
Last name, F.
Wow. I have no idea.
Kyle Freeman. No, Kirby Freeman.
Kirby Freeman. I remember Kirby Freeman, yeah. Okay. Kirby Freeman was a really good athlete from Texas who probably would have been better 10 years later.
Actually ended up finishing his career at Baylor.
Yeah.
All right. Ask me a question.
Okay. This question is from Dave in Redwood City.
Hey, that's like 15, 20 minutes from where I am right now.
Okay, maybe you guys can get coffee. All right, gentlemen, love the pod. Scott Frost going to from Stanford to Nebraska was a name missing from your impact transfer discussion. He wasn't the player Joe Burrow, Troy Aikman, Russell Wilson, the OU guys, nor Cam were, but he was 24-2 as a starter on the mid-90s Nebraska wagon, which is pretty dang good. I would agree with that.
He definitely, like he was an option quarterback in those days. They didn't put up big stats, but he did lead them to the national title. And it does, you know, I'm obviously very familiar with Stanford now. Nobody transfers from Stanford as an undergrad. Did he have his Stanford degree by the time he transferred to Nebraska?
I don't know.
That's very, very unusual. I mean, obviously it worked out for him football-wise.
And it's going home for him.
Yeah, so. And he was going home. You know, his brother is Stanford's...
is an announcer, yes. Yes.
They're announcer. And he looks exactly like him.
Let me ask you a question from Kirk Crawford. Do you think it's possible that an impact of NIL will be the creation of a premium league comprised of rich college programs that can afford to pay higher for NIL? Say 30 or so teams. We've already seen free agency where players are leaving for higher NIL compensation, and programs that aren't willing or able to retain their better players will be unable to compete with the premium teams. Maybe there would even be a non-NIL conference. What do you think, Stu?
Well, I've been saying for years that I think eventually there will be a Premier League of the 30 or so most, however you want to put it, basically the biggest TV brands in college football that go off and kind of sell their own property, like just like the Premier League in England or even maybe the better analogy is Champions League. Doesn't mean that those schools wouldn't still be in the Big Ten or the Big 12 or the SEC for their other sports, but for football, they would play in this confederation. This was well before NIL became a thing. I don't think NIL is going to be the make or break factor. I think it's much more TV. I wrote about this actually in the written mailbag Wednesday. The amount of money that is being talked about for the next Big Ten TV deal. They make $440 million a year now. There's talk they could get to $1 billion a year in 2023. The SEC TV rights are about to skyrocket as they go from CBS to ESPN. Like, this is kind of already happening on a conference level. The Big Ten and the SEC, I don't know that you can actually say Power Five all that accurate anymore. I feel like those two are separating themselves from the other three. So... now, my idea, the reason my idea may never come to pass is that the SEC may just say, we are the Premier League and screw all you guys who are trying to block our playoff and whatnot. But yeah, NIL, maybe I'm being naive, but I just really think it's going to eventually be, it's very jarring right now. It's eventually just going to be like a normal part of college athletics. That part of being a college athlete is you get to cash in on your marketability.
Yeah, we shall see.
Our last one from Kerry Floyd, Lawrenceville, Georgia, UGA class of 99. He addressed this to both of us because we're both parents. I think my daughter is a little too young for this to apply, but Stu and Bruce, do you have a favorite college football memory that you've shared with your kids? I ask because my 9-year-old daughter had never shown any interest in college football, but decided to watch the UGA Clemson game with me this year. She loved it and then watched every second of every UGA game with me the entire season. By season's end, she knew most of the players and was more excited to watch a game than me. She napped all day of the championship game so that she could stay up to see the game and the trophy ceremony because she just knew, quote, Kirby would be the most excited person on the field. That's really awesome that the national championship Georgia season, which was such a big deal to all those fans, obviously, in general, became such a bonding point for him and his daughter. My daughter knows what college football is. I wouldn't say that she is yet paying any attention to it. But obviously, Ben, football fiend, I'm sure you have a story like this.
I do, but the story I want to share is actually more of an NFL-related one. So it's a Friday night. This is probably a couple months ago. And we are watching A Football Life, which is the hour-long documentaries that NFL Network has. I like them. I think they're well done. And we're watching the one on Kurt Warner. And it's about 30 minutes in. And, like, because he's seven, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't remember a ton of stuff before. Like, he doesn't remember the Mannings, you know, like, just because they played before, you know, like, he was really paying attention, right? But, so we go through the part where, okay, this is the John, like, and now he's learning history. Like, he has seen the video of the grainy video of Walter Payton running up a hill. And, you know, Jerry Rice's training stuff a lot on YouTube. Like, that's stuff he's curious about. Well, anyway, you know, there's the part of Kurt Warner's career where he's with the Giants. And even though he plays well, he's very supportive of Eli getting his career off the ground. And then he ends up with the Cardinals. And there's a quote from Larry Fitzgerald, or a soundbite from him talking about him. And then it's like, similar situation, young hotshot quarterback they drafted, and he's competing with the guy. And I'm like, you know, the hotshot quarterback, at one point they show a highlight of him. And I was like, Ben, you know who that is, right? And he goes, no, I have no idea. I was like, that's Matt, being Matt Leinart, who he's been around a lot. Like, you know, like, just because of who I work with and everything, like, he's raced Matt, you know, like, you know, on different time, you know, whatever. So he was like, Matt played in the NFL? I'm like, yeah, he played in the NFL. And I'm like, I was like, you know, he was a great quarterback at USC. And I think because he sees that me and Rob Stone work at that same place, like, and we didn't play in the NFL, and so why wouldn't Matt be there? And I was like, yeah, you know, Matt did, the Wendy's guy did, because he just knows Reggie as
the Wendy's guy.
Like, it's hard for the Wendy's guy, and it's hard to separate. He's number five from USC. You've watched his film on YouTube, but it's just interesting to, like, when it's out of context for little kids. So, you know, he likes Notre Dame. He didn't realize that Brady was a great player at Notre Dame. You know, it's just like, it's interesting how little kids learn. And I think in the case of Carrie, you know, where you're getting it in real time, like, I definitely have seen that with my son, where there was, and this was the original, like, where I was going with this. A couple of years ago, I think he's still five, we're watching LSU-Texas A&M game. And the game is obviously going, like, deep into overtime. And at one point, I'm sitting there going, I don't know if it was almost, it was after 9 our time. And it's like, all right, he needs to go to bed. And I was just thinking, you know, my own personal childhood, which I remember, like, having to shut the TV off at a certain time. And I'm like, I'm not going to be that parent. If he wants to stay up and watch this thing, assuming it doesn't go into 15 overtimes, I'm going to let him do it. And he could tell you the exact score. He can remember a lot of details from that night in that game, which was obviously one of the great games of all time. And it was a Saturday night, so I'm like, all right, how much bad parenting am I doing by letting this kid stay up probably an hour past his when he should be in bed? So,
as I'm thinking through,
and I'm glad for Carrie, he's getting, and his daughter are getting these really cool memories that they're going to share. And I imagine that when Carrie's daughter is, you know, 20 years from now or 30 years from now, when she have kids, it'll, you know, it'll be kind of like those family things that you'll always have with you.
Yep. My daughter definitely, like, understood, I think, what was going on with the Bengals and how I was getting so into the Bengals. But it's not like, you know, we had for the Super Bowl, we had over our friends who the dad is also from Cincinnati. And but, you know, Madeline's really good friends with his daughter, and they just ran around playing the whole time. It wasn't like she wanted to sit and watch the game with me. All right, as always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Bruce, anything else you wanted to hit on?
Yeah, I just wanted to give our condolences to George De Leon's family. He was the longtime Syracuse offensive line coach and an offensive coordinator, and he coached at a bunch of schools. And I, you know, a lot of times people only know the head coach, you know, because they're the ones who are out in front. And I don't think You know, especially in the Northeast, the impact George De Leon had on football coaches and football players is pretty profound. And I do want to, you know, mention this. It's mostly with coaches, I think, that really, really stood out. But I did notice this when I woke up this morning. It's from Joe Thomas, the legendary all-time great offensive lineman from Wisconsin, who later played for the Browns, and that's where he worked with George De Leon. George De Leon was one of my favorite coaches of all time. Nobody had more unadulterated true love for the game of football. Nobody gave me more passion for the game of football than George. We called him General George in the meeting room because he was tough but fair, had a way of getting the most out of his players, and never wavered from his core beliefs. He built trust and a desire to give your all for him. He truly embodied everything you want in a coach at any level or in any sport. He was everything that was great about the game of football. George De Leon will be dearly missed by anyone who had the privilege of crossing paths with him. That's very poignant, and I think if you talk to a lot of people who've been around George De Leon, whether they're high school coaches to learn from her, college coaches to learn from her, or former players, they will echo what Joe Thomas said.
Yeah, I definitely think he was, you know, more so than most assistants, kind of synonymous with, you know, the Paul Pasqualoni era at Syracuse. It was kind of, he was always attached to that. Like, everybody knew what a big part he played in that. And then he went on to coach for another many years after that. I did not realize that he was so closely working with Matt Rhule at the end there. He was Baylor's O-line coach in 2017 and then stayed on as a consultant for the next two seasons after that. So, yes, our condolences to his family. He passed away on Tuesday at the age of 73. We're going to come back quicker than we did last time. We will probably have a new episode for you on Monday, where we may or, well, we probably will be talking about a usually very popular annual staple of ours. So we'll see you next time.